Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
Hello there, you welcome along to this evening's football show. Coming up later on, we're going to check in with familiar voice Pat Nevin. He is on the way, but first, another familiar voice. I'm very happy to say Philippe Auclair, you are most welcome. It's been a while. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I'm as well as the circumstances allow me to be at the moment, which is not so bad.
Well, good, good. The world a very surreal place at the moment. Are you in France or are you in London or where?
I'm in London. I'm in London looking at grey skies today. And what else is there to say, honestly? I could be anywhere else. I'm in a flat. And a pleasant flat. So I'm not complaining about that. There are many, many people who are far worse off than I am right now.
From a footballing point of view, the French authorities, like so many, were scrambling and coming up with various plans to finish the league. And there was talk about resuming on the 17th of June and maybe finishing the campaign by the 25th of July. And then all of a sudden, the irrelevance of those plans was laid bare when the French Prime Minister stood up and said, no, you're not. And you're not doing it behind closed doors. You're not doing it anyway whatsoever. And so suddenly that looks, Philippe, like that is it for this season when it comes to League One and League Two, or no?
Well, I'm not so sure this is the end of the story. I'd rather say it's perhaps the start of another one. First of all, there were the words used by the Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, at the Assemblée Nationale yesterday. And football was mentioned almost en passant in a sentence which was about the 2019-2020 season in professional sport, including football, notamment le football. There were no indications precisely as to what the Prime Minister was actually advocating, apart from the fact that, well, you know, guys, you cannot play, that's it. You cannot play, and the earliest you could possibly play would be probably the 1st of September. Now, this was immediately interpreted, and I have to say that the way he spoke about it made this interpretation quite plausible, was that the season was, that was it, that was the end of the season, and then it would be up to the French Federation, the French FA, and the French League, the Ligue de Football Professionnel, to come to an agreement as to what would be the decisions taken related to the end of the season. But having talked to quite a few people, and believe me, I've talked to quite a few people over the last 24 hours, it appears things are not perhaps as clear-cut as that. And that, for example, the hypothesis that games could be played behind closed doors in so-called secure conditions, sometime in August or in September, to finish the current season, is not something that the government would necessarily be against. What they said is basically, we've got to stop thinking about these crazy schemes to restart football in June or July. It's not going to happen. You have to know that. Then afterwards, it's up to football itself to take the decisions. And on one hand, you've got the French FA, and I'm sorry if it's a bit complicated, but if you don't understand everything I'm saying, because it would probably be the best possible way for me to explain to you what's happening, is that not everybody understands what is going on. The French FA is very clear. That's Noël Le Graët is very clear that the season is over, it's finished. The position which were on the league table at the end of the 28th round of games, that's the final position. So we have a champion, we've got clubs which qualify for Lyon and Marseille. We have clubs which qualify for the Champions League, which is PSG, of course, the champion, Marseille second, and Rennes third. Lille is in the Europa League, so we think. And then we've got the clubs which are at the bottom, and really hard luck for Amiens and Toulouse, who mathematically, in the case of Amiens, still had a chance to save themselves. They're relegated. And Nîmes will play the playoff, or there will be some sort of thing arranged with the guys who are supposed to be promoted from Ligue 2. So that's the opinion of the French FA. But the French League hasn't yet come up with a solution. So in a way, the season is over, but we don't know what's happened. Have I made myself clear? Or is it as unclear as it should be?
No, that makes sense. So the French FA and the French League have a different interpretation of what's going on here. Or certainly we don't know what the French League's interpretation is.
Not yet, no. And also some of the clubs have accepted what was presented as the end of the season. Others, obviously, it all depends on where you are in the table. If you are Amiens, you know, Toulouse, it doesn't matter because Toulouse had 13 points and there were something like 16 points off place in the league table. But for the others, I mean, it's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. And it's also an economic disaster. I mean, you will have seen that it's estimated that if you take the example of England, of the Premier League, should the competition stop now and not be resumed, I think the Premier League clubs would lose something about 1.3 billion. That's been estimated. The estimation where you put together sponsorship money, TV money, and ticketing money. In France, which is not a league which is as rich, obviously, as a Premier League, it's estimated to be about 760 million euros. That's a huge amount of money. And French football simply doesn't have the means to cope with that, as perhaps the Premier League does. So you can imagine that quite a few club chairmen are a little bit worried about what's going to happen to them. But there are also people who are saying, and I was talking yesterday with Ligue 2, which is, you know, second division, a chairman of a club which, to be honest, it won't make much difference whether the season stops now or carries on in some fashion later in the summer. But he was saying, you know, one thing that many of the people within football agreed was that there was something quite weird and perhaps even immoral about football being completely forgotten as a participation sport. Like, nobody can play in the parks, nobody can play in the lower divisions, in the amateur divisions, when it would actually be safer to play in front of 20 people than in front of 2,000 or 20,000. And why is it that elite football should be treated differently? You know, shouldn't football start from the bottom up, which is, by the way, I believe, what the World Health Organization, one of their experts, has been saying today. So at the moment, we're in a state of flux, and we were hoping that there would be some kind of clarity, as has been the case, for example, in the Netherlands or in Mauritius, which was the first country to actually put a stop to the season. Belgium, we still don't quite know, apart from the fact that Cercle Brugge is champions, but there are still quite a few things to be loose ends to be tied. And in France, There are still quite a lot of things which need to be decided. Apart from the fact that we're not going to play until 1st of September, that much is clear, which is perhaps the one thing that should attract the most attention elsewhere. When you hear the plans in Spain, when you hear about the plans which are less firm in Italy, when you hear about the Germans, I mean, Christian Seifert of the Bundesliga has been saying, which sounds to be completely insane, as it starting again from 9th of May, it's not going to happen. So it's perhaps the French attitude has more is more interesting in terms of what it says about the current state, the sanitary state, basically, that we are in at the moment, which means that resuming this type of competition, even behind closed doors, is impossible until the 1st of September. It's a message that is, you know, very, very strong. And you wonder how it's been taken on by the other four big European leagues. And it's going to be very interesting, because either France is going to look like a complete, you know, a buffoon because people will have resumed elsewhere, or they will look at the people who have actually taken the right decision before the others.
Mm. And it's very hard to know. You have a range of attitudes. So even, for instance, to pick up on your point about football starting from the ground up, Javier Tabas, the president of La Liga, he is talking about the announcement in France, and he's talking about what should happen in Spain. And he is very much of the opinion that we're talking about an industry here. You know, he says that, I don't understand why there's more danger in playing football behind closed doors with precautionary measures than working on an assembly line or being in a fishing boat on the high seas, etc. And he said, if important economic sectors can't restart in a safe way, they could end up disappearing. That applies to football. So there's the romantic from the ground up approach to football, and then there's the approach to football, which is that it's an industry and it needs to be saved. Regardless, I think your wider point is the interesting one. So France have made this decision. The Dutch have made their decision. The Italian sports minister has poo-pooed, really, any hopes of a return. And equally in Germany, as they've eased certain other restrictions, not football and sport, but other restrictions, the OR rate, the reproduction rate, has gone from 0.7 back up to 1, which is the danger line, as in, if I get it, I give it to one person as opposed to 0.7 of a person, which is what you need for the disease to die out, in effect. So even though that gentle easing of restriction in Germany has resulted in the infection rate rising again, so suddenly the Bundesliga could face a severe reality very soon. Where is UEFA on all of this, Philippe? The last I had heard were two things. They want decisions from the leagues about whether they're going to cancel the seasons or postpone them by the 25th of this month. And then they're hoping to finish the Champions League in August. Is that the hope?
Yes, the next big meeting is on the 27th of May, and they want to know what each league's position is going to be by the 25th. And there is obviously the temptation, which is something that I've been thinking about for a while. I dared not actually say it loud because I was afraid somebody might pay attention and actually think it was a good idea, which is to play football in places which are not hit by coronaviruses as hard as Europe. And I'm very interested in the fact that probably the first big league globally, which is going to start again, is going to be the Chinese Super League. And it's a big league in terms of financial power. And I was thinking, well, there is nothing that would prevent, say, UEFA, if they wanted to have a tournament, a summer tournament, to organize it in China. Why not? If it's safer there, why not do it? Of course, there are plenty of reasons why it should never happen. We all agreed on that. But the fact is that UEFA is dependent on the revenue of the broadcast revenue of its competition, if it's a chief competition. And therefore, you must find a means to make it happen. And if, as is likely, because I think we all need a good injection of reality, because football has been living in cloud cuckoo land for quite a while now, it's probably impossible to have any kind of tournament before the autumn, right? It's probably impossible. The idea as well that French teams would be allowed to participate in a European competition when they're not allowed to participate in national competition, that's also an interesting one. So you think there are possibilities which are there. If you think about football as an industry, you can actually export the competition. So you're back to the old 39th game of the Premier League, but in a completely different context. And that is for UEFA. But you could imagine, and there was actually, I mean, at one point, there was this crazy rumor which was circulating that there had been secret talks. I'm just saying these are rumors, by the way. It's just to give you an idea of what people are talking about, of Qatar proposing to host the Champions League, a kind of final eight, which, of course, is out of the question, if only for climate reasons, because it would have to happen, you know, in August or something like that. So it's not going to happen in Doha at that time of the year. But it is a possibility that has been mooted, certainly to have it played somewhere where, to be honest, the environment is safer than it is in mainland Europe. So why not China, for example?
I know the PSG, somebody from PSG said that they would look into playing their home legs in the Champions League outside of France if the Prime Minister's ruling is as it seems.
Nasser Al-Khelaifi, the chairman of PSG, absolutely, yes.
That's a possibility, I would think. I mean, if UEFA want, they can make this happen. It just will be slightly different and maybe there won't be home and away as we know it.
It will be. Again, I think that we tend to, I think it's very, very interesting that when we talk about football, we tend to enter a strange realm where reason and rationality don't seem to matter anymore, because we all see things as if they hadn't changed, and we all see things as if they belong to a kind of an order that was in place before this happened. And we are, honestly, we're thinking about scenarios which are improbable, irrational, and I think, with personal opinion here, which are ethically completely reprehensible. And we seem to think that it's perfectly okay. That's the Tebas argument, that we are an industry and therefore we should be able to do that. Well, Mr. Tebas, there are plenty of other industries which are hit just as hard as football, starting with the creative industries, starting with theater, music, and so forth, where actually it's even worse because there's no possibility of doing anything for quite a long time and probably much longer because it's confined space and closed space and so forth, that's gone. And so why not make an exception for those? And it's this thing of what I think the German call it, the König Fußball, the idea that football is king and that somehow its priorities are more important than any other priorities. I think it's an idea which is going to be very, very difficult to sell to public opinion. And I think as we go along, I think it's going to become more and more difficult to sell this, and including in the world of football itself. This is not just me giving a personal opinion. I am also talking about discussions, conversations I've had with people for example, player syndicates, trade unions, from people who are working within clubs at executive level. And there are a number of people who say that it's not right. It's not right. We don't want the players to become the guinea pigs of an experiment whose sole aim is not to save lives or to make things better, but to make money and provide a kind of entertainment that honestly is not going to be very entertaining behind closed door games. It's not fun. I can tell you that. Where we've seen some, it's really not fun. So, and within the game itself, I think there is a current which at the moment hasn't been given a lot of space, but of people who say, I don't think we're looking at this the right way here. We have to take an approach which is slightly more detached. We should take our nose off the glass or the looking glass because we're looking at ourselves and have a look actually from the outside. Is it possible? Is it rational? Is it not? Perhaps it's possible at one stage, you know, to start again in August or September at some stage, you know, with limited number of people in the audience and so forth, all these sort of things. But at the moment, when it comes to UEFA and the plans to have actually the Champions League being played in August, and by the way, in which conditions? I was talking to a physio, by the way, of a club yesterday, who was telling me, trying to explain to me how difficult it was going to be to get the players ready again, because it's going to be the longest holiday pre-season that they've ever had. And actually, we're in an area here where there aren't many elements to know exactly how to work, because when was the last game played? If we say, you know, late March, something like that. So we're already 6 weeks in. So we've already had the holiday. So we should be, and it's a long holiday by football standards. We should be in a pre-season. And also we've got to think that the bodies were conditioned to be in peak condition at this time of the year. So we don't know. And that's, again, that's a physio speaking, somebody who works with a top club, by the way, and who says, at the moment, we're experimenting. We think we're doing the right things, but we'll only know when we actually start training properly again and when we start playing. And then the other thing is that when we start playing, if we want to conclude the seasons or if we want to have this final eight, it's going to have to take place within quite a short space of time. And which is why, for example, you've probably seen that the idea of using five subs so that to lighten the physical impact on players. That FIFA actually came up with that proposal, which is cosmetic, to be absolutely honest. But if the players are not ready, you can't play. And it's also another thing which is shocking many people from within the games, thinking, well, we don't even think about that. You know, you can spend all the time you want in the gym. You can spend all the time running around your garden or doing your 5 miles, your 5Ks outside your home, and you can swim and you can do all these things. That's got nothing to do with conditioning, nothing to do. That's not it. You might be fit, you'll be healthy, but you won't be match fit for quite a long time. It's a new situation. We might be in a situation where top players on whose organisms huge demands are made suddenly find themselves having to play coming out of something like 3 months inactivity. Nobody knows how their bodies will react to that en masse. You know, it's as if a whole team was coming back having been injured. As you think, that's not good, is it?
I think you make brilliant points, and I agree wholeheartedly with most of them. And each evening as we report on the football show on the various plans for a return, it is extraordinary how nobody is stepping back a bit more and looking at the bigger picture. And there are various aspects to it. And number one, and this argument seems to have taken hold, particularly in the UK, and the UK government seemed to be open to it, which is that people need something to distract themselves. They can stay in their houses and watch these games. And one, that does people a complete disservice because, frankly, they can find other things to do, and they will quite easily. Dare I say it, they might read a book or watch Netflix and they can get by. Secondly, who needs to watch a meaningless mid-table Premier League game? And if Liverpool win the league in 2 games' time, who needs to watch Liverpool play in an empty stadium against West Brom or whatever? It's all a bit pointless. So people don't need it. You know, that argument doesn't stack up. On the economic argument, which is the Javier Tebas argument, I mean, football is a multi-billion dollar industry. There is so much money sloshing around this game. And very simply, the reality here is that UEFA and FIFA will have to get together and they will have to sit down and say, we're going to have to borrow against future earnings. Future earnings, which will come back, and they'll be massive. So we need to borrow against them. We need to keep the game afloat in the lower leagues. And if it means that clubs down the line can't spend hundreds of millions in transfer fees, then so be it. And the multi, the clubs, the big clubs owned by billionaires will be just fine one way or another anyway. So FIFA and UEFA, and the economic argument, you know, clubs will go to the wall and all this will happen. Again, FIFA and UEFA can go to any bank in the world and borrow whatever they want. Now, they don't want to do that, quite clearly, for obvious reasons, but they can do that and they can keep the game afloat. And then points 3 and 4, which you referenced as well, player welfare and also just the resources, you know, the ethics of deploying resources which might be better served in the interest of everybody's health now going towards football games, be they testing kits, be they ambulances, be they any number of other things I'm not thinking of. So the notion that we can't just draw a line under this and say, we're probably done here until Christmas and let's reconvene and let's not impose this pressure on ourselves. That's the discussion that football needs to be having right now. And the key discussion there is, what will UEFA and FIFA do to protect players and teams in the lower reaches of the game? And that's where we should be at. Not, as you know, you kind of teased out there how nonsensical it gets with their notions of Champions League knockout stages in Doha.
It is insane, isn't it? And yeah. I think there were news today of the first women's team in England going having to fold. We're going to see this happening with an awful lot of other clubs who depend on ticketing in particular to pay their bills and who can't do that. So I agree with you entirely that the Solidarity Fund and the people who are squealing the loudest are the people who stand to lose the least, to be honest. I mean, I'm a football journalist. I've taken a huge hit. Like you have taken a huge hit. I mean, I'm a freelancer. I don't have any work or very little work compared to what I normally have. But I think I'm big enough to understand that I'm also a member of society. I'm also a citizen. And that, you know, common good and collective good has got to be taken into a consideration here. That doesn't seem to be the case. And I also would say one thing, but taking your eyes off what is, you know, the looking glass again, if you look at it, which are the countries at the moment which have done the best at controlling this awful thing, and you look in Europe in particular, and if you look in Europe, who are the ones who have done best? Greece and Portugal. Not the richest countries in Europe, the ones which acted the quickest. Portugal acted much quicker than anybody else. They have actually, I would say, they're on top of things there. The Greeks as well have been very swift. They're on top of things. I would say the Mauritians in Africa were perhaps the ones who acted in the most rapid and decisive way. I will tell you one thing about Mauritius. Number of victims from the COVID-19, 9. Population, 2.6 million. Mm. So, it's these people we should be looking at who've taken the right decisions very quickly, but they've taken them to they've embraced them to the hilt. And once you do that, then you're allowed to reopen more swiftly. So the problem is football and not just football. If Ireland and England and France had acted more quickly, our footballs would have been able to start more quickly as well, which is why the Germans are ahead of everybody else, because they acted more quickly and more decisively. So we shouldn't look at football being dissociated from the rest of what is happening. I mean, it's absurd. Mm. Even the very thought is totally absurd. And again, as you say rightly, the FIFA is sitting on $2.5 billion at the moment. UEFA is perhaps not in as healthier situation financially, because it does depend on the revenue of the Champions League to a greater degree. And also, don't forget, there's the Euro, which is a big money spinner, has been moved back 1 year. So that's a problem. They have a more pressing... But at the moment, interest rates are not exactly very high. Yes, you can borrow money at quite substantial, at quite good rates. And I don't think that banks would necessarily be against the idea of lending to people who can actually get so much more money in their own coffers. It's taking a gamble, but it's a gamble worth taking. So, yes, it would be possible to do such a thing. But unfortunately, the response, and that's one thing perhaps which also teaches us about the way that football is fragmented and atomized. Instead of having one common discourse, even if UEFA and FIFA are starting to find common ground, we have the FIFA discourse, we have the UEFA discourse, we've got the French government discourse, we've got the French FA discourse, the French League discourse, the Premier League discourse, the Bundesliga discourse, and we carry on like that. Premier Liga, the Eredivisie, the Jupiler League, you name it. Everybody has got their own opinion about everything. So the discourse is completely atomized. It needn't be atomized, because there are things which are the same in every single country. And we were talking about player welfare and health. That's everywhere, absolutely everywhere. When we were talking about European competitions, it includes all the teams and all the countries which are still a role to play. And by the way, it also is about the qualification process for 2020-2021, which is clear as mud still. So there are all these things, but unfortunately, to solve them, even if you go within a single organization, you go within the French League, you realize you've got 20 clubs, you've probably got about 6 or 7 different opinions. Completely, people want to resume, people want to play behind closed doors, people who don't want to resume, people who want the season canceled, people who want the season postponed. You look at England, it's probably the same thing. You want people who want the season canceled, or who want it... and it stopped, and people who wanted to continue. There is no common discourse yet. And we've been in lockdown for how long? Well, a long time. It feels like a very long time. We've been in lockdown for weeks and weeks and weeks. And during all this time, we've wasted our time. Football has wasted its time by imagining, making crazy scenarios about, remember what people were saying in early March. Remember what people were saying before the Premier League suspended basically itself after Mikel Arteta was found to have contracted the virus. Nonsense. And everybody with half an ounce of sense knew it was nonsense. But the interests were so big, so powerful, that this discourse, which is all about short-term and medium-term, was allowed to take precedence. The kind of newsy side of it was allowed to take precedence, when we should have said, no, let's not even go there. That's ridiculous. You're not going to play. We know that. And we all knew that. And we're now discovering that reality has bitten back, and it's got a very good bite indeed.
Philippe, fantastic stuff. Thanks so much for that, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, my pleasure.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
Now, you're welcome back. So that was Philippe Auclair with a good dose of common sense before the ad break. For more on that front, we are joined by Pat Nevin. Hello.
How are you doing, Joe? Are you well? Are you okay?
Very well, very well. Coming to you from my upstairs. I'll be heading into studio a little later on. So that is the plan. The sun is shining. We've had a lot of nice weather here over the last couple of weeks, which I think has made life a touch more palatable.
Certainly more bearable. If you actually can see me just now, I've got the best tan that I've had in years, because I've been out running every single day. Fortunately for where I am, it's been sunny every single day up until today. So that's helped everyone, but certainly in the south of England and coming up towards Scotland now, it's not so good. And I think that's a couple of people I've talked to, you can hear there's a wee difference in the voice. You know, just even that half an hour or an hour you've got outside, it really lifts you if it's sunny, but it's not going to be like that all the time, sadly.
not to pry, but the last time we spoke, just at the very end, I said I hoped your daughter was doing well, and you mentioned she had had COVID and was back working in the hospital, which was great to hear. So was it a, you know, without wanting to pry, I emphasize, she came through it okay? It wasn't a horrific experience for her?
No, the funny thing is she wasn't worried about it at all. When she got it, she wasn't concerned about it at all, because what most of the medics know is that the numbers are still, if you do the numbers and the calculations, you know, if you're young, you're probably quite unlikely to get very, very unwell. Most people will get it with limited symptoms, and most people, even if you get quite severe symptoms, it'll be a heavy cold, it'll be a touch of flu, it'll be things like you lose your sense of smell, taste, that sort of thing. But it's very, very limited amounts, although grotesquely sad for those who do go into the extreme stuff, you know, and have to get into intensive care. But what she knew all along is that that was highly, highly unlikely for her. So, and very much in the Nevin spirit of, hey, worry about it when it's time to worry. And before then, there's no point. And as it classically goes in one of my favorite movies, when asked, you're going to die in the morning, aren't you worried? Will it help? You know, it does. Worry about it when it's time to worry. And she never did. And she's back now. But I think her more biggest concern was, like most NHS workers, she's in the hospital now and dealing with what she calls a grim time. It's really grim. You're seeing the worst, people at their worst, people who are the worst affected, you know, and all throughout the hospital. It's hard times because, you know, the percentages who eventually do go into intensive care and are on respirators, the percentages after that are not good at all.
And is the hospital coping okay? Because the fear every hospital had was that it would be overrun.
And the great thing is, because of obviously most people have understood the, you know, limitations of going out, it's they've had, got this extra massive big conference centre in Glasgow just across the road, which is all ready to go and never been used. So the hospitals have all managed to deal with it here. And then that's the big thing about it. That's what everyone's doing. I'm sure every country is exactly the same. You know, you've got a good health service here, particularly in these islands. And you're thinking to yourself, look, if it does, you know, if it's an exponential growth that we're not expecting, you need to be ready for it. And that's exactly the way to go. But no, hasn't been used yet. And it's just the same as everyone else. It's personal protection equipment's a big problem. And that's the problem for everyone. It's gone on here to people that are, you know, that are in care homes. That's the mega concern at the moment. That's the numbers that are going down there are really huge.
Yeah, that's a grim picture. Well, I'm glad to hear she's back at it and working hard and things have gone well on that front. To throw something at you from left field, literally. So we had Lee Dixon on Sunday's show. In lieu of not having Premier League commentaries, we've been getting on former footballers and doing an hour with them on their life and times. And he said something which I thought of you, actually, and I thought, I bet Nevin is in this camp as well. I bet he is. So Dixon was talking about the various left-wingers he had played against, you know? And ultimately, he concluded that he found Giggs the toughest over the years. And one of the ingenious things, really, I mean, without overstating it, but certainly logical, but one of the ingenious things that Giggs did was, at all times, said Dixon, Giggs was absolutely silent. So it meant that as a right back, and he had Giggs somewhere outside him, he had to maybe be looking over to his left to see what was going on in the play over there. Say David Beckham has the ball and he knows Giggs is outside him somewhere, but he doesn't know if he's 3 yards off him or 15 yards off him or is moving or not moving, because he said most left wingers are just always calling for the ball. And it's like a sonar, you know, they're letting you know where they are because they're calling, you know, when they're moving, how they're moving. He said Giggs is just this silent presence outside of him. And so invariably you'd have to look to your right to see where Giggs is, and invariably as well at that moment Beckham will kick the ball over your head and suddenly you're flat footed and look a bit foolish. And I thought, isn't that clever? And he asked Giggs about it later and Giggs said, yeah, why? I mean, I was in a good position, they're good players, I'm not going to let you know where I am, effectively. So I thought that little trick or that little insight would be right up your street.
I'd love it. I'll be honest, hands up, I wouldn't have considered using that one because basically I wanted the ball all the time and maybe I didn't have quite that quality of players who were pinging it to me as regularly. Maybe when I was playing with Everton, he had Sheeds on the left, he'd see you anyway. So basically the best thing is to get the hand up. That's it, hand up. It's the biggest one. And by the way, you can shout and scream as much as you like when there's 35,000 people there. not going to hear you for 30 years. There's no chance anyway. So it's a kind of, it's kind of an automatic thing that people do. But every tiny little trick like that that you can possibly use, that you can possibly do. I mean, some, one of my favourite ones over the years was saying you were injured. So I'm calling over to the manager, oh, my leg's gone, knackered, really gone. The next time the ball comes, ping, off you go. Just get inside your guy's head, think, I thought you were injured, kind of thing. So any little trick you could use, gamesmanship, you absolutely use it. I like that one by Giggs. I mean, it's certainly one that I wouldn't have considered using, but I'm sure I've told you about it before. My silent one was always against Pierce, Stuart Pierce, pure silence. It's got the same from him, nothing, give nothing away. And maybe that psychology thing was my bigger side of it that I wanted to work on. But yeah, and the other thing about Giggsy, you got to know, he is quiet, you know. He is really quiet. It's kind of hard to get anything out of him. When you spend time with him, you know, it's really hard to get him talking, especially out with the confines of the actual football ground or, you know, the training ground or whatever. Getting him to talk out with that's actually not that easy.
Yes, I suspect it was in keeping with his character as well.
Yeah.
It just jumped out at me almost as an example of how picking the brains of defenders and what they don't like could be a highly valuable thing for attackers to do, because it took Dixon's perspective to almost understand why that was such a tricky little thing, the silence, I mean.
One of the other things, you're talking about defenders understanding, you know, from what, if maybe they played an attack for a little while. The amount of guys, you never see a centre-back, I rarely see a good centre-back becoming a good full-back, right? It just doesn't happen. But now and again, a centre-back can become a centre-forward because they know what they hate. They know where they hate to be, you know? And you've seen that over the years, a number of guys that have managed to actually do that and make that sort of transition. And that's because you know exactly where the weaknesses are. You know where you don't want them to go. With most centre-forwards, I always felt the vast majority of the time it was just kind of, they never really thought about it too much. It was just kind of a natural thing. They went into those sort of areas. But really good strikers really thought about it and really considered it about it and considered, you know, the phrases that we often hear on the telly now, like, make sure you see the defender's number. You know, if you see his number, and if you know he's in a bad position, he can't see you. All that sort of stuff. There's millions of little tricks like that throughout the game. You spend a lot of time during your time playing not telling anybody any of them, because you're thinking, if I give that away, everybody will get to know that one. That's always the thing that amazes me. After a game sometimes, it doesn't happen so much in the UK, certainly even less these days than it used to. People ask the manager about tactics and that, and every now and again a manager actually explains them, thinking, what are you doing? You've just blown that. It's beyond me why any manager would ever just tell the truth in that situation. It's utterly beyond me. And certainly one of the other things, if I was ever asked in my entire career, what's the manager doing behind the scenes tactically, I would either change the subject, say something completely, utterly nonsensical, or else just say, I'm not telling you. It's amazing how many people fall into that little trick. You journalists, you're all the same.
What kind of things would a defender do which would be the most troublesome? Like if a young fullback was coming to you saying, what can I do for a tricky, jinky winger that makes life horrible for him? Is it getting really tight the second the ball comes at your feet? Is it almost standing off you 10 yards? And like, no, so what did you hate?
Bad mistake to get too tight. Certain types of players, I'm desperate for you to come tight. In fact, I want you really touching me because I'll just roll you. I mean, I've manipulated situations all through my career to get somebody actually touching my back so I could roll them. I knew exactly where they were. Everybody, it's a classic when they say, get touch tight. Hello, I'm loving that. It's about a foot, a yard at the very, very most, no more than that, because you can see their movement. If you're too close to them, you can't see their movement if they're good with the tricks and the skills. So that's one thing that's kind of important, that that you get that precise space. If they're too far away, you've got time to turn and run at them. So there's a very specific area where if you've got that between a foot and a yard, if you start to turn, they've got time to manipulate it and then go in and hit you. It's amazing how few of them figure that out. I mean, it's different for different types of, you know, attackers, but that was the thing. I learned it off a guy called Sandy Jardine, who'd used to play for Rangers in Scotland. He was a fullback, and I played against him when I was like 17 and he was 38. I could not get by him. And he explained to me as I was walking off the park why I couldn't get by him. And I said, why are you telling me? And he said, well, I'm never going to play against you again. And I said, oh, are you going to retire? And he goes, oh, thank you. He goes, no, you're going to go to better things than Clyde. But, you know, pass on the information when you get it to other Scottish people. It was really great that you could actually do that. There are those little things for different types of your tackles, and it's very, very technical with different types of players that you play against. Some of them, my most hated one I can own up to now is I just despise playing against anyone who was the same height as me or smaller. Doesn't happen very often, but I just hated it because all my advantages were actually gone at that time. So you couldn't manipulate your turning circle to be of use. So tiny little things like that. But if you were marking me, you know, if I was trying to explain it to you, you'd almost have to take it through step by step by step by step, where you go in every single different position. Because whether you're facing me, where I've got my back to you, I'm side turned, all those things are slightly different positions, which the very good defenders know what to do.
And do you see the quality of one-on-one defending improving over time? Are fullbacks better at it now than they were in the 90s and the 80s and so on?
Well, it's different now. One of the massive, massive different things is the game's got less contact in it now. You can't lump any tackle because you miss time a tackle. It's a booking, which was never the case. So you do actually get less people just taking a chance in a mad lungy tackle. So most people aren't actually making the tackles now. What they're doing is showing you into space. They're slowing you down as much as they possibly could. I actually think that's good defending to do that. So that big part of it has changed massively in the game. The other thing that's changed massively is you don't get that many one-on-ones anymore. If you think about it, if you close your eyes and think about Zaha on the ball or Eden Hazard on the ball, or any of those really quality players, when's the last time you actually see them with a one-on-one? You just don't get it. The way that it's manipulated against players who are quite rare, but they're good at one-on-ones and dribbling and running past people. The idea is just never allow it. Very rarely allow it. It was a classic one I watched last season. If you watch Zaha playing, he almost never gets one-on-one, right? Everybody knows Palace stop Zaha, you stop Palace, right? So they always make a double cover, one of the defenders comes over, deep line midfielder, all that sort of thing, right? Except last season, Chelsea had a player, and it was Reece James, and they just went, no, you take him one-on-one. And I was like, what are you doing? This kid, second game. And they went, no, he'll be okay. And he was okay. And it really jumped out at me because it was that unusual to see it. I mean, it was unusual when I played. I very rarely had a one-on-one. Almost always had two players on you the vast majority of the time. So what it is about manipulating situations that you finally get it to a one-on-one. And if it's a one-on-one and you're any good, you should get by. That's what I used to think anyway.
It's very interesting because the 1968 European Cup final was on TV over here on Irish TV on Virgin over the weekend, and the picture was touched up very nicely and the commentary was good, and it was really interesting to watch it. And there was a player, I must confess, I hadn't ever heard of, Johnny Aston on the left wing. Now, I don't know, did he just have the game of his life? He may well have, because even the Benfica coach afterwards was, I Googled it. I was like, I can't believe I've never heard of Johnny Aston, who it seems to me was man of the match in the European Cup final. And the Benfica coach was saying, I'd never even heard of this guy, really. I was worried about Best and Charlton and all the lads. But it was one of those games where he had the beating of his man. And so the system didn't really protect his man. It was just like, I'm just going to continually beat you now. And Benfica aren't going to react all that much. That's in 1968, admittedly. But it jumped out as being so rare nowadays that a right back would be thrown to the wolves like that.
Yes, I've seen it happen a few times. I can remember once playing for Scotland and Stevie Clark was asked to mark the left winger for the Netherlands, who just happened to be Ruud Gullit that day. And you're thinking, don't do that. Don't do that to anybody. And Ruud was on it that day. And you just think, it was just unthinkable. I was on the bench and I got on for the last 15 minutes. I didn't think about anything else. I'm going to go and help him. That's it. Gordon Strachan told me a great story. He says how the game had changed from, as you were saying, the 60s and even before that. Because he remembered he was being told by Stanley Matthews, who was saying, I don't understand the wingers today. I used to get the ball, I'd go up to the the fullback, and I'd either dummy left and go right, or dummy right and go left, and I'd go by him with pace. And I don't know why they don't do that. And Strack said, well, there is the deep-lying midfielder, the deep-lying winger, the left fullback, and the sweeper coming across. Kind of changed a wee bit since your days. And it did get a little bit, or a lot more technical as time went on. And I think that started, it kind of became noticeable in the mid-70s onwards. But it was generally only the best teams, the very good teams that were doing it. You know, certainly lots of teams did it before that, but it grew tactically, it grew really, really quickly over that sort of period. And that's why you didn't really get those situations that often.
Yeah. Strikes me then you might have played at a particularly tough time in that tactical sophistication was getting there and defenders were doubling up, but equally they could still kick lumps out of you. A sweet spot for you.
Yeah, well, and say, add on top of that, the worst thing about it all, somebody asked me to go and put some video tip together of, or video wasn't video, it was stuff that was online, but in DVDs and things of games that I played in. And honestly, it is hilarious. I'm thinking the game would just be abandoned with the pitches. You just wouldn't even think of playing them. And that was a normal pitch. It was ridiculous. It was a game, and I hadn't seen it before. Someone sent me, it was on YouTube, and it was a game, Arsenal, we were playing Arsenal down at Stamford Bridge. I swear to God, I'm watching it. I can only laugh. I really can only laugh. You're thinking, it is impossible. In the modern looking vision of it, you're looking at it thinking, that's actually not possible to run with the ball in that. It's a joke. And it was like that a lot of the time. So, yeah, it was a different time, but hey, there was positives as well in that time. I would reckon levels of fitness of all the players, I mean, some of the players were stunningly fit and would be perfectly fine today. The very top ones are the good ones, the ones who were dedicated. But now and again, there would be guys and teams that wouldn't be absolutely the fittest. You just found out where it was and you just ran them. You actually won't get that now. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. So some things that are good, some things that are bad, some things at a time that I don't really complain about it, you know, because you deal with what you have to deal with during your time.
So as we round things out then and take a step back from Ryan Giggs and left wing play, what's catching your eye at the moment in the game? What's jumping out? Are you reading stuff every day and following the when we're going to return, when we're not going to return? Are you watching old games or are you just taking a break from football in the main?
I've not actually had time to watch old games and get myself so fit. What I've tried actually to do, I mean, I'm doing, as I always do, quite a lot of writing, that sort of thing just now, but I'm trying to keep on top of what everyone's saying about it. I spend a lot of time in a number of other shows, like, well, for the World Service and things, and if I'm going to be talking about what's going on in the game, I have to be knowledgeable about, you know, what the French are doing, you know, what the Belgians are doing, what the Norwegians are doing, what UEFA are saying, all that sort of stuff. So you're absolutely on top of it, but also thinking beyond it. Something jumped into my mind. Two things jumped into my mind the other day, and I'm sure someone talked about it, but I hadn't heard it. And it was, you know, say they start the leagues back in 6 or 8 weeks, right? And there's some suggestion of doing that behind closed doors. Some of the players won't want to play. They'll just say, no, I'm not playing. Why should they? And you've then got a kind of really dodgy legal position there. They can say, I'm not playing, this is dangerous. Now, I've actually seen that before. Quite a few times during my career, we went on tours to places and some of the players would say, no, I'm not going. That's too dangerous. It's okay, fair enough, it was Iraq. Some of them didn't want to go, I got that. Some of them wouldn't go to China because Tiananmen Square had happened quite recently before that as well. If there was something going on in that area, some players just said, no, I'm not going. And it was generally kept quite quiet. I think now there's a number of players, and I think it's not necessarily fear for themselves. It's fear for, obviously, the family or extended family, parents, all that sort of thing. And might just say, no, I'm not going. And then they also might say, I'm not going, and say it because fear of illness, when in actual fact, they've got 20 minutes left of their contract and they don't want to get injured, you know, so they won't play on through July. Why should they? Because they've got a new club to go to, and if they break their leg during that period of time, they're stuffed as well. I heard another one recently which I hadn't considered. I mean, all the technical problems and, you know, try to organise all the different things if you're going to get a group of players together. How's the police going to keep everyone away? Now, if you're going to hold it somewhere, hold these games somewhere, the police almost have to, or will demand that you throw a ring around it of a huge amount of numbers. Police haven't got the numbers to actually do this. I hadn't even considered that yet. You're asking the police to take their numbers from elsewhere, and there might be different situations arising, and put a massive ring around this huge complex area where players are going to be playing. So I try to keep my head on every single angle of where this possible comeback of games falls down. And it's, I know it could maybe happen, but the F has now got a massive big capital I on it.
Yes, no, it's very true. That just before you joined us, that was essentially the thrust of the conversation with Philippe Beauclair, so I didn't want to necessarily double up on that. But yes, the road back is just full of absolutely ginormous problems, and then a whole bunch of very, very small but not insignificant problems.
I would say one, just to link you to the previous conversation we had, it would have been easier to do it 30 years ago, much easier to do it. You didn't have the same amount of medical staff. You didn't have the same amount of rules to follow. You didn't have the same amount of players you had to bring on board. You didn't have the expectation of all this amount of time to get ready for a game. You just got on with it kind of thing. So all the staffing and all the background behind it, all the massive television and media thing you have to add on to the top of it as well, you didn't have that. The numbers were smaller and it was manageable. The only way you could actually, not the only way, but one way you could actually do it is just strip all that stuff out, strip everything out, and don't make it all singing, all dancing. Make it utterly simplified and a very back to basics model. And I just don't think we'll do it. I just don't think that's going to happen, because the numbers and the way that they do it now, with just purely even just to get that type of television that people demand, it's so difficult to imagine it happening.
Yes, yeah. Well, on that note, we'll say good evening for this evening and check in next week, I would suspect. Pat, thanks a million.
See you soon. Take care.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.